Welcome to the Flow Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 2:30. That is Pacific Summer Time. Today is August 5th, and of course, being Friday, it's a big picture, long-term audio for the various different asset classes. And if we first have a review of what's been happening this week, then it's been, perhaps what's happened today has really been the defining moment, because the Dow Jones has bounced back. It was up 1% today. The S&P 500 up less than 1%, but at a new all-time high. The Nasdaq 100 at a new all-time high. The banking sector starting to bounce back. The transportation index pushing areas of previous resistance. It really is about this week, at least. It was all about USA preeminence, and that extends also to the bond markets, where what we've had was because of the UK lowering interest rates and announcing a £70 billion. And despite the fact that those are much diminished pounds, that's still a $100 billion quantitative easing program, which is open-ended. In other words, they said they're going to buy $60 billion of sovereign bonds and $10 billion of corporate bonds, which is a new departure for the Bank of England, but has also been employed by the ECB. And when they're starting to talk about that, then they've said very clearly that they're going to keep it wide open, that if they need to indulge in additional monetary accommodation, that's exactly what they're going to do. Then, when we look at the USA, the question, of course, is how likely is it that they're going to follow suit? Because if the UK is going to adopt this quantitative easing program, if they envisage that it could have a duration of a couple of years, if we're going to be looking at uncertainty in Europe for at least the next couple of years, and not least because there's a German election next year, and Mrs. Merkel, who is coming to the end of her third consecutive term, is falling in opinion polls, and then she has been roundly castigated for her approach to the refugee crisis, and not least because of the spate of terrorist attacks that there have been in Germany. So it is very much open to question whether she is going to be Germany's next prime minister. And that is a potential source of uncertainty for Europe over the medium term. And that's quite apart from the fact that the banking crisis is far from resolved. But when we look at, so you have negative yields in Europe, you have negative yields in Japan, you have easy monetary policy in China, you have quantitative easing and monetary accommodation in the UK, and there is a large swathe of the sovereign bond markets globally are trading at negative yields. The big one, of course, is what's going to happen with the US. And then how likely is it that the US would renege on its commitment to raise interest rates? How likely is it that they will step back from their commitment to raise rates? Well, that's a very big question, and it's rather unlikely considering the relative strength of the US economy. And then there are clear differences between the US and Europe, or indeed Japan, and or indeed China, because the USA forced the banks to write off the losses. There was an incredibly traumatic period of foreclosures where the non-performing loans were worked through. The USA's banking sector isn't exactly profitable at the current stage, and that's more because of the low interest rate environment, because of the tightened regulation and the increasing expense of compliance, but it isn't because of non-performing loans. And that's really quite different from what we have in Europe or Japan or China, where there really is a problem with non-performing loans. Now, the UK is somewhere in between, because the UK's banking sector has got some exposure to the Eurozone problems, but by the same token, it has taken greater steps to solve some of those problems. And there's also the additional fact that the UK came out of the Eurozone's financial crisis in better shape than a number of the Eurozone countries, and that's not least because it has its own currency and can adopt a monetary policy that is appropriate just for its individual economy and not that of 17 or 27 other additional countries. Now, when we look at what exactly is going on in the US, then the very big question is, how likely is it and at what pace the Fed is going to start raising rates? And I do believe quite clearly that it is down to the ability of wage growth to take off. And today we had it isn't so much about unemployment. There's definitely people entering the workforce, and there were more jobs than people entering the workforce. That means that the unemployment rate stayed relatively steady, but so did earnings growth. Earnings growth is still around 2.6%, and that's a statistic that comes out once a month, and it came out again on the 31st, and it was up to the 31st and released today, and was unchanged. But what is important is that when it originally broke out, which was last year, about 2 months later, that's when the Fed raised rates. So that is the one thing that they are very conscious of, is wage growth, because it is one statistic that is very difficult to hedonic out of the economic statistics. So and it is directly inflationary. So that is something that is going to be very carefully watched. And then, how likely is it the Fed is going to raise rates in September? Well, I suspect that it is very unlikely, for the simple reason that wage growth was a pretty staid in July, and we're not going to get another update on that until the end of July, and then the Fed decision would be very soon after that. So they're going to be cautious, and they would likely want to see that wage growth sustained for another month, which would take them into October. But of course, the election is in November, and you don't get to be Fed governor without being a political animal, and they've got to be very aware of the fact that their job depends on political, well, at least on politicians awarding it to them. So then the likelihood of an interest rate increase before December is looking reasonably unlikely at this stage. But what the bond market is telling us is that the deflationary panic that we had in June is being unwound in treasuries, but not so much in Europe or Japan. And today we saw that US yields posted a higher reaction low. So that increases the potential that US yields can unwind the overextension relative to the trend mean. And at that point, I think then there's a big question, but we're still a fair way away from that, and you would really need to see it trading above the 200-day moving average to signal more than temporary supply dominance, because the dollar index is currently around 96 and a quarter, and that's just a bit more than halfway through the range, and it continues to hold this progression of higher reaction lows, having posted a failed downside break in January. So it is looking likely that we are going to go right up and test the upper side of that range, which is about 100. But there's nobody in Washington wants to see a strong dollar. There's certainly the US is aiding the growth of the rest of the world right now, because the trade deficit is increasing, because the dollar is firm, so that is inhibiting the USA's ability to export, but it is making imports cheaper. So and that's particularly good news for places like Europe and China, but there isn't anybody wants to see a very strong dollar, because that would inhibit growth, and it would also act as a headwind to the Fed's ability to raise interest rates. So there is nobody wants a strong currency, but there's some need a weaker currency more than others, and right now the countries that need the weak currencies are in Europe, and particularly the UK, as it heads into the negotiation phase of its exit from the EU. But Japan is in there as well, and the yen has strengthened pretty substantially since they announced quantitative easing, since they announced negative rates, because negative rates are inherently deflationary. And the euro has been very steady since they introduced negative rates. And there has got to be some bright spark in Tokyo and in Frankfurt that recognizes that having a negative interest rate is deflationary when and acts completely contrary to their stated objective of attempting to court inflation. Because considering the amount of debt that there is out there and the just how difficult it is to get rid of that debt without inflation, then it is only a matter of time before they go for outright money printing. And because the banking sector is in such terrible shape in Europe and in Japan, then the potential is that they will circumvent the banks and begin to send money directly to consumers to kickstart consumption. And that is the very definition of helicopter money. And it does look like it's increasingly likely. So therefore, when we look at the precious metal markets, then you know, silver today was down really quite sharply, and it's now back below $20 once more. Gold prices were also weaker in here today. They're down to $1,335. Palladium, which really has had a remarkably consistent advance, is trading back below $700. And while it was off its low, it has now broken the progression of higher reaction lows. So I sold my long in palladium because I anticipate that we are in for some consolidation of what really have been just spectacular advances in precious metals. And I no longer hold precious metals, having in June had all four. But I am watching quite closely for an opportunity to re-enter the market because I continue to believe that this is a medium-term bullish scenario, that what we're really just getting in gold prices and silver is the first meaningful consolidation following what has been a remarkably impressive breakout, and that significant pullbacks, or most particularly pullbacks towards the region of the trend mean, represent buying opportunities. Because in the event that we do go for helicopter money, and it really does look like it is only a matter of time, then asset prices will inflate at least in line with the pace of inflation. And that means that stocks, precious metals, and property will all benefit. And then the bond market will be under quite a lot of duress. But of course, we're in an era of central bank interference in the markets. And one of the things that they've been doing is they've been mandating that banks have to hold more Tier 1 capital. I'm sure you've heard that in the news. But of course, what that actually means in fact is that banks have to hold more government bonds. And insurance companies have to hold more government bonds. And, well, that's been fine, because government bond prices have been going up and going up at an alarmingly quick rate. But what happens when bond prices start going down and you still have those rules that banks and insurance companies have to hold their government bonds for Tier 1 capital? And of course, if the price is going down, then they're on a mark-to-market basis, they would actually be compelled to own more of them. They'd be compelled to buy into a falling market. And that would look pretty messy. So then we're at in a sort of a period right now where we have very accommodative interest rate policy. We have a number of countries adopting outright quantitative easing. There is the increasing likelihood that we are going to have fiscal spending increasing in the UK, in Europe, in the USA, in Japan, and in China. So we have the potential for synchronized monetary and fiscal expansion. And Wall Street, as the not only the leader and the least affected market by the troubles in the EU's banking sector, is outperforming. And it's also because they have a healthier banking sector overall. But what we're in for is, it looks like, we're in for a period of asset price inflation. We've had plenty of asset price inflation over the last few years already, and it's been liquidity fueled, and it's not over. And the likelihood is that we are potentially now entering the third psychological perception stage, where then we are in a period of time where there is plenty of money. We know what the problems are, but the problems have not reached a crescendo just yet, and it might be a couple of years yet before they reach a crescendo. And that means that in the third psychological perception stage, that it's not just that everybody gets the message, that people get way over leveraged, and then we get prices really starting to outperform. And what are the reasons? So what are the kinds of things that support that? And I think we've covered the point that there is plenty of liquidity about. And you can't have a big bull market without a great deal of liquidity. And then this is it, that central banks printing inordinate amounts of cash and deploying them in the bond markets and in the corporate bond markets is a massive source of liquidity for this market. You can't have a big bull market without a big bull story. And of course, the big bull stories are that you have the rise of the global consumer, that not only do we have an additional 2 billion people, but that they are increasingly reaching their productive capacity. The rise of technology is also enhancing everybody's productive capacity, and not just that 2 billion additional new consumers. That the advances that we're having in the supply of energy is removing a headwind to economic growth, and in fact acting as a tailwind to individual productivity. And if you have productivity growth, then you have the potential for bull markets. But when that productivity growth is rolled out to almost the entire global population, minus those countries that have a deteriorating governance, well, then it is, you know, and of course it is the countries with the deteriorating governance tend to make the headlines, and it isn't those that are doing everything right, because you know, there is that witticism that if it bleeds, it leads in the news sector. So what do we hear about? We hear about the Middle East. We hear about Syria. We hear about the spate of terrorist attacks. But what we don't hear about is that Dilma Rousseff looks increasingly likely that she will be impeached. That there is a new prime minister there. That commodity prices are improving. So therefore, Brazil might be about to turn the corner. And certainly the real looks like it has turned the corner, that Macri in Argentina is doing all the right things. And I haven't seen a news article lauding the investment attraction of Latin America in quite some time, and yet they have very high yields in a global environment where there is a distinct lack of yield. And then we look at India, and just this week, India passed really a landmark law, and this is something that got very little play, but what it means is that there's going to be a GST in India, and that's going to replace, it isn't that they didn't have a GST before, or they didn't have sales taxes before, but that they were different in every state, and there was a whole slew of competing regulations between states and competition between states, and that's all being swept away, so that there's going to be a uniform GST right across the country. And just by getting rid of so much red tape, that's a phenomenal achievement for the government of Narendra Modi. And again, that is something that we hear very little of in the mainstream media. So there are clear pockets where high population countries are really achieving improvements in governance, and that's particularly the case in ASEAN. But what we don't have is improving governance in Europe, and the Eurozone really does need to get its act together, and it does look like they're going to require an additional crisis in order to really take their heads out of the sand. And without changing the trajectory, they are going to have another crisis. So that represents a potential threat. But at the same time, the very existence of that potential threat ensures that the excess liquidity on which the market depends is likely to continue. So we're in this sweet spot, which one could sort of think about in terms of the 2003 through to 2005 or 6 environment, where the Fed was raising interest rates, but doing so at a very moderate pace. And in this case, the Fed raised rates once last year, and they might raise rates once this year. So instead of it being a quarter of a point at every meeting, it might be a quarter of a point once a year. And that would take 4 years to get up to 1%. And obviously, that's there is no evidence to suggest that that is, in fact, what it is going to be. But it is it would be in tune with the fact that the Fed is going to be incredibly careful about what they do, because they have worked so very hard to achieve the growth rate, modest as it is, that the US has now got, and the last thing they want to do is to put it in danger. So they're going to be incredibly careful, and it looks increasingly likely that the Fed might want to keep interest rates basically where they are and allow for the fact that the US might adopt a fiscal bump after the election. But that would suggest that we are again, that would increase the potential that we're moving into the third psychological perception stage, that everybody gets the message. There is going to be lots and lots of liquidity, and in a low to negative interest rate environment, the only way to make money is to get long and stay long. And that being the case, then that is the kind of thing that people start to get very enthused about, and then people start to think about, well, is it ever going to change? Will anything ever, nothing will ever change this environment. We're going to have low interest rates forever, that we've got a global deflation that is likely to last forever. But that is certainly not the case if we get helicopter money. There is a very clear deflationary impact to the rise of technological development, but in the event that we get helicopter money, then that is because that is so directly inflationary, that and because the debt to GDP ratios, the outstanding debt of corporations, the personal debt in the G7 in particular is such an overwhelming burden, that inflation is the only way to deal with it. And yet we haven't yet got there. And in between when we get there and now, we could have a phenomenal bull market on Wall Street. And that could be led higher by everything that we've already discussed. So then the logic would be to be long, and to really keep an eye on Europe, because the ECB is doing whatever it can, and what it can do is a lot to try and reinvigorate growth in that economy. And now that they have adopted quantitative easing, and it's probably going to be a while yet before they dispense with negative interest rates, but because we have indices like the DAX now trading back above its 200-day moving average, then that is the kind of market that is likely to do well, and not least because it is loaded full of companies that really do a lot of business outside of Germany and the EU. And of course, that is the reason that the FTSE 100 has been outperforming, because it is loaded with global autonomies that really do very little of their business in the EU. So then there are definitely going to be opportunities in Europe as well, but it is the US that is leading the market higher. And I thought it was very interesting today that Bristol-Myers Squibb, which is a globally successful biotechnology company, and it fell today by about 14% on a disappointing result from a stage 2 or 3 trial, but it had very little impact on the healthcare sector, and it had no impact at all on the biotech sector, because despite being one of the biggest biotech companies, it is not on the biotech the Nasdaq Biotech Index. And what we continue to see there is a higher commonality, or high degree of commonality in the biotech sector, and it does look like it is on a recovery trajectory and breaking out of a medium-term base and breaking a more than year-long progression of lower rally highs. And this is a very different environment than we had in the 1990s, because these companies have products, they have cash flows, and then they have product pipelines as well. So we start taking it all together then, that there are clear risks in the bond market, but that doesn't mean that the bull market is over just yet. And when we look at the potential returns that one can acquire in the stock market, and not least because there are such a large number of stocks yield substantially more than is available on the bond market, and have the potential to increase those payouts over time rather than the fixed rate that one would get in the bond markets, that the attractiveness of equities in an environment where we have such a large amount of liquidity sloshing around, I think is an argument that there isn't much argument with. It's probably a better way to put it. When we look at China, then they are still attempting to transition from an infrastructure focus to a service focus, and they've been largely successful so far. But there are some, you know, really quite large outstanding problems with non-performing loans, and they haven't yet decided how they're going to deal with that, and they've been brushing it under the carpet for quite some time. And until I think that we really do have that problem taken care of, then the stock market isn't going to be trending higher in a sustained manner. But at the same time, neither do they want it declining. And it really does look like they are supporting that 3,000 level on the CSI 300. So China is relatively steady in here. But of course, Hong Kong, which has got US interest rates, is much more on a recovery trajectory, and was up today another 1.44%, and is pulling away from the region of its 200-day moving average. Now, if we do have a bullish environment overall for precious metals, and we have a bearish environment overall for energy prices, then that's really quite good news for the mining sector, because energy represents a cost, and higher commodity prices represent a profit. And there is the potential here that, and it is something that we do look at as a quite typical late in the cycle event, is that you get this outperformance of the commodity sector, and that has been led so far by the precious metal sector, and a very substantial rally so far from the low a few months ago in the oil sector. But the industrial metal miners have not rallied to the same extent as precious metal miners, and yet they are firming up, that the majority of the industrial resources do look like they've found medium-term lows, and iron ore in particular as being one of the more important ones. But copper continues to hold above $2 a pound on COMEX. And provided it can continue to do that, then the potential for the mining sector to stage a late in the cycle rally would continues to remain the base case. And we wouldn't anticipate that the mining sector is going to be a lead indicator, since it's rallying so late in the cycle. So it is important to watch what have been leading sectors. So the dividend aristocrats have been a leading sector, the autonomies, globally oriented companies that have benefited enormously from all of the bullish factors and the excessive liquidity and the ability to borrow at next to nothing. So they have done phenomenally well out of the environment such as it is, and a move to sustained underperformance by that group would signal that things really are going astray. And the health of the banking sector in the US is another one to watch, because it is certainly not leading the market higher, but it is turning back to a position of outperformance again. It does look like that demand is being reasserted, and you cannot have the broad market going up and the banking sector going down. So the banking sector really does have to at least perform more or less in line with the wider market in order to lend its support. And of course, the other thing to watch is the yield curve spread, and it is contracting, but we're still a fair way away from it turning inverted. And even then, when it does become inverted, that's only likely to represent the beginning of a topping phase. And it's usually a lead indicator of between 12 and 18 months. So there are a lot of bullish factors in the short to medium term, and the very real possibility that the breakout that we've had now from the NASDAQ, from the S&P 500 and the Dow Jones represent clear upward breaks and are likely to go further and farther than anyone has really thought possible while they were still ranging. And I think with that, I will leave you for today, and wish a good weekend to all of you.